This is WBCR LP Great Barrington, Berkshire Community Radio, broadcasting at 97.7 FM and streaming at berkshireradio.org. Stay tuned for a Farm and Garden Show with Jay Allison Moscariello and Bill Taylor. We will discuss resiliency and regeneration with permaculturist and author Ben Falk, whose Central Vermont farm has been a laboratory in whole system design for the past 20 years. First, some upcoming events. The Great Barrington Seed Library needs a coordinator to provide this community resource. Contact the Great Barrington Public Library at 413-528-1619, extension 6000. Once again, that's 413-528-1619, extension 6000. Summer Farmers Market season is starting this month, May. The Copaic Hillsdale Farmers Market is at 9140 Route 22 in Copaic, New York. May 18th to November 23rd, Saturdays 9 to 1. They accept Snack, Fresh Connect, and Double Up, located at Roliff Jansen Park. Great Barrington Farmers Market is at 18 Church Street in Great Barrington, May 11th through November 9th, Saturdays 9 to 1. Except SNAP offers Market Match, HIP, WIC, Senior Farmers Market Nutrition Program. Lee Farmers Market is at 25 Park Place in front of the First Congregational Church in Lee. It will be starting May 25th, running till October 12th, Saturdays 10 to 2. They accept SNAP and offer Market Match, HIP, WIC, Senior Farmers Market Nutrition Program. Market held rain or shine. Lenox Farmers Market is at 134 Main Street in Lenox, May 24th through September 13th, Fridays 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. The new location is at St. Anne's at 134 Main Street. Millerton Farmers Market is at the Millerton Methodist Church, 6 Duchess Avenue in Millerton, New York. Saturdays May 18th to October 23rd, except SNAP and Double Up Bucks. New Marlborough Farmers Market is at 134 Hartsfield, New Marlborough Road. It's on the Village Green, Sunday, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. May 19th through September 1st. Those are Sundays, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Otis Farmers Market is at 200 East Otis Road in the parking lot of Papa's Healthy Food and Fuel in East Otis, May 25th through October 12th, Saturdays, 9 to 1. Pittsfield Farmers Market is on the Common at 101st Street in Pittsfield. The summer market runs May 11th through October 12th. Except SNAP and Market Match, HIP, Senior Farmers Market Nutrition Program, and WIC, powered by Roots Rising and Teen Run. Sheffield Farmers Market is at the First Congregational Church, 125 Main Street. Except SNAP and offers Market Match, HIP, Senior Farmers Market Nutrition Coupons, WIC, and Berkshares. It's at the First Congregational Church. West Stockbridge Farmers Market is at the Foundry Green on Harris Street in West Stockbridge, May 23rd through October 3rd, Thursdays, 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. Except SNAP, Market Match, WIC, and Senior Farmers Market Nutrition, located on the Foundry Green at Harris Street, rain or shine in a lovely setting. And there are other markets. BerkshireGrown.org is the place to look. There are markets in north part of the county, Lanesboro, Williamstown, North Adams. Berkshire Botanical Garden in Stockbridge offers many classes on gardening, horticulture, cooking, and other garden-related topics. The website berkshirebotanical.org/events has listings. Phone is 413-298-3926, and email is info@berkshirebotanical.org. And now we'll move into today's interview. The Whole Systems Design Collective identifies, designs, and develops whole human habitats. It brings together a research farm, plant nursery, and professional landscape architecture practice. They are an ecological design and landscape architecture firm committed to creating spaces that are nourishing for people and the places we inhabit. They offer clients a unique working knowledge of regenerative landscapes built on decades of work on their research farms and proving grounds in Vermont and client projects around the country. They work with public and private clients across a variety of scales, from small homestead, farm, and orchard designs to community and agricultural master plans, campuses, and public parks. Their multidisciplinary approach integrates ecology, agriculture, urbanism, building, and multiple craft from design through management. They focus on providing an in-depth, iterative design process. As with the results, Their process is tactile, facilitating a client relationship that is transparent, engaging, and in preparation for living with the systems they've co-created.
So greetings, Benfalk. Before we get into it, I just want to let our listeners know that Benfalk founded Whole Systems Design to share his family's discoveries on their northern Vermont farm. From heating systems to growing rice in Vermont, his book, The Resilient Farm and Homestead, 20 years of permaculture and whole systems design, is a recently released second edition of the book, which we have the first edition. And before going much further, let's hear from our author, Mr. Benfalk. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me here.
Yeah, we're so glad that you're here. And now that we're now on the East Coast, when we interviewed you last, we were on the West Coast.
So tell our listeners about whole systems design and making a home landscape, a laboratory, and when you started on this project.
Sure. Well, it could be traced back before college, wanting to have a life that was outdoors. And then I think eventually somewhere in high school, deal with ecological problems that I was becoming aware of. And then in college, that just being more and more acutely concerning. Then somewhere in college, I began to work for some carpenters and put up some timber frames and different buildings where we were working with architects. I was made very aware that there was just a total disconnect between the built environment and the biological environment. Like, you could even have a pretty darn nicely designed house that's passive solar and maybe even low VOC, non-toxic, very well-performing, kind of quote-unquote sustainable, let's say. And 95 out of 100 times, or maybe even 99 out of 100 times still, actually this is the case, they really don't consider the site very carefully. The sophistication is all in the buildings and the technology, and then the integration with the larger ecosystem, that enmeshing, of which, of course, it's inextricably affected by and affects in turn, was just ignored, that integration of those two parts of the systems, built and biological. So that really was a eureka moment of, we need to design whole human habitats, not just buildings, not just landscapes, but the whole habitat system for people. And that was also influenced by people like John Todd, who I had been lucky to take a course or two with at UVM, University of Vermont, who's a forefather of the modern ecological design movement, influenced by people like Bill McDonough, Jay Baldwin, Stuart Brand, Buckminster Fuller for that, and then the permaculture movement, which Bill Mawson especially made perfectly clear. He had realized this disintegration of design way back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And so, yeah, it's been a process of trying to fix that problem, so to speak. The world is still full of disintegrated design with high sophistication in siloed aspects of the design and one part of it, but lack of a holistic, across-the-board, horizontally integrated intelligence of the design, where the ecological and built systems are unified and co-supportive. But we focus on doing that for our clientele, our clients, and ourselves. Primarily, that's how I've learned to do this work more than in any other way, is not just through study, but through living it day to day and managing two sites every day of the year and seeing how they respond to my design and management decisions. Mm-hmm. Now we're in about year 20 some odd for the business, and our first site is in year 21 and our second site's in its 11th season. We're walking around, it was just climbing 55 foot walnuts the other day, pruning them, and I planted those trees when they were 2 feet tall. Wow. That was actually a few years after I got to our original site. So if we have people start this stuff when they're in their teenage years, mm-hmm. The possibilities are just mind-blowing. Like, everyone in their 40s with their children could be building tree houses for their kids in 70-foot tall trees that they planted. And all the benefits beyond that, of course, of the perennial food system and ecological benefits, habitat, nectary for birds and pollinators and everything else. We just need to help people realize what the possibilities for them to creatively contribute from a young age. I mean, people like David Orr really helped me understand that, especially when I was in college, accelerate young people into positions of leadership and empowerment, especially. I was lucky to get on land when I was 25, so I was started pretty young.
Yeah, you did.
And of course, we've moved away from people being able to access land now with affordability challenges of everything. So in some ways, I think we're further away from it now than we were when good luck being able to get a site now when you're in your 20s to manage. It's just the affordability challenges are so severe.
I think Mark Shepard talked about using credit cards to buy land, and he had a lot of different ways to do it.
Yeah, you got to get more creative than ever, that's for sure. I'm not an expert on that front.
Tell me, Ben, how do you make a home and landscape sustainable? I'm looking at our place and I'm remembering what you just said. I'm keeping that in mind. And they obviously didn't have a sustainable landscape and permaculture, any of that in mind when they built this house. The one thing that they did have going for it, and it's a big one thing, especially in New England, is that it was very south-facing. So, and we have solar panels that really help with the efficiency. There's a lot of good things, lots of windows.
And it's a masonry heater.
It's a masonry heating. But all that aside, there was no thinking about how are we going to feed ourselves. There was none of that.
We've been working on that.
Sure. Yeah, of course. Yeah,
for those who haven't read your book yet, and I absolutely encourage them to do so, what do you look at? What is the first thing one should look at?
Yeah, really, it starts with the site, right? The larger context. You don't start with your building, your floor plan of your house, which is often how the process starts. That's like going to a doctor's. You have a health issue and you go to the doctor and he just starts with a blood test or a prescription even before understanding what do you eat? How's your life doing? How's your home life? What's happening in your life? What are the forces that are affecting you? So what are the forces that are affecting where your home is going to be, your building's going to be, your life is going to be? Sunshine, the path of the sun, how the water moves, the angle of the slope, the aspect of the slope, which way it faces, wind, access, microclimate, soils. These are all of the things that we do site analysis and assessment of. That's what the permaculture design system is rooted in. And that's what any proper landscape architecture should be rooted in. It usually isn't enough rooted in an understanding of the natural processes and features of the site. Like what is there and what's happening there, the features and processes. Oftentimes we overemphasize the features actually a bit. All right, there's a cliff and there's a pond and there's a wetland and there's a steep slope. But we miss the processes. What happens there? Well, in the winter, there's these northern winds, or in the spring, there's this frog song from the wetland. Let's take that into account. You know, the things that are moving through the system, wildlife habitat, there's a deer wintering yard here. There's a wildlife corridor. Those are more subtle, but they are just as important to take into account. What is the path of the sun each day and how does it vary across the year? So we have to understand, we have to have ecological literacy be the basis. Have to understand what is on site and what happens on site so we can harness those features and processes to maximum benefit, to allow our homes to be heated with as little outside unsustainable energy as possible. And that's also costly. The sunshine is free, to avoid flooding and other water problems, to harness gravity-fed water and have water move where we want it to our own benefit without additional infrastructure energy, or to reducing those energy loads, et cetera, not destroying the best soils by putting a house there, avoiding damaging the site as much as possible, et cetera, harnessing natural energy flows is the principle in permaculture that comes to mind. But there's many others. Many of the permaculture principles are about this, how to make our actions congruent with the larger patterns on site so that we synergize with them. As Buckminster Fuller says, we don't oppose the forces, we use them. God is verb, he says, not noun. It's active. So that's the basis of good site analysis and assessment. And then design is built on that. But I don't go to a site and start waving my hands around like many architects do, saying, I have a brilliant idea. Really, the whole art is I'm not trying to impose the design from the outside. I'm trying to listen to what are the forms and materials that this place tells us are going to work best here. Let the site and the ecosystem and the goals and the particulars of the people there, let the design from those pieces. It's much more of a listening process. Our work as designers is much more of a facilitation process in that way than a bring a bright idea in, a brilliant idea in from outside. That's what's dominated architecture and landscape architecture in the modern era of these genius, quote unquote, designers.
Absolutely.
But the real genius design is the people who listen to the place most carefully and most astutely. It's in indigenous designs, especially that we see that have lasted for oftentimes thousands of years, the way the Anasazi built their passive solar villages in the high, cold desert Southwest. You know, understanding microclimate at a deep level, the way Mayans moved water and one inch drop in a couple miles that we really can't even do with like GPS and lasers right now very well. Things like that. So to me, that's what's exciting about design, because that's endless and it's mysterious and it allows us to tap into the depth of the place. It's ecocentric, not egocentric.
I love the way you speak about these things. It's so poetic and beautiful. You bring up such beautiful imagery. Who on earth doesn't want to do this?
Yeah, I think everyone does when they learn about it. It really inspires people. I mean, that's why we get people coming from all over the world to take our permaculture course, to take other permaculture courses, to learn ecological design in all of its forms. It's not just a permaculture thing. It's not the approach that is popular in a kind of command control, high energy, like high force dominant society, right? We can heat a 6,000 square foot house, no problem. Put a big enough boiler in and have the oil truck come, fossil fuel truck come a bunch of times. The oil's there, it's flowing. Yeah. It just takes money and force. And so we've just dumbed ourselves down. I mean, essentially, the more abundant, easy fossil fuel energy we've been able to access, the dumber we are able to get and still get by. It's a dumbing down process, because we can be illiterate to all of the free natural energy flows and processes of a place, the more subtle stuff, and still, quote unquote, succeed in today's society, especially if you have enough monetary resources. But that's an impossible situation. It's not going to last. It's on its way out. Whether we have decades more, hundreds of years more, who knows? I mean, unfortunately, there is a lot of fossil fuel left, despite what I used to think and what some people still think. You know, there's 300, 400 years of coal left. We can keep destroying the biodiversity and the health of the world for a lot longer if we want to choose to. But just to get back to your question, if we increase our awareness of these more subtle ways of partnering with soft energy paths, natural energy flows at younger ages, then I think we have some hope. It's a process of alignment, right? With the world at large.
Yes. Now, some of us feel smug because we drive electric cars and we have an energy efficient house. And then you do a beautiful thing. I don't remember if it's in the new edition of the book or if it was in one of the YouTubes, but you compare a walnut tree to a solar panel, and which one is more productive?
You can't compete with biological energy flows. The best we can do with technical, quote unquote, solutions is cause less bad. They're never regenerative, right? An electric car may be less bad than the straight fossil fuel car. It's a fossil mineral car because it has to store energy, and that's with fossil minerals. But it's not like a plant. I mean, think about a tree. It's actually improving a place. It's making oxygen every day of the growing season. It's making soil. There's no waste it's putting out. There's no negative output of that system. Whereas the best thing with our technical systems, with technology, is to just cause less havoc in our wake. Okay, we made less toxic waste driving this way than that way. We mine less ancient resources, but it's still damaging. It's just a question of what's less bad. And as Bill McDonough and others have outlined very compellingly for many years, is sustainability, which is based on that, is the idea of doing less bad, is really not terribly exciting when we could actually be regenerative, when we could do good. I mean, Bill McDonough uses the example, like, how would you, if someone said, how would you find your marriage? You said sustainable. You'd feel bad for that person. It's not really a positive. It's just, I did less bad. And so that's not a viable goal, right? I mean, the best result would be, I should be not here. I should not be an eating, consuming human being, because if the best I can hope for is less bad, well, the best thing would be for me not to be alive and exist. That's a perfectly nihilistic philosophy there. So there's not a viable operating system.
No.
But what we learn through permaculture and other life ways, indigenous life ways, especially many times, is that we can do good. We can leave high levels of biodiversity and soil and groundwater recharge and good things in our wake from us doing our day-to-day lives. It's super challenging in today's context to do that. But it is possible. And that, to me, is a worthy goal.
Ben, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. Let me ask you this, because what keeps coming up, especially when you're talking about the Indigenous lifeways, which I'm so on board with that. What about the children? Are you having any success getting these kinds of courses into public school places?
It's a great question. I haven't spent really any time working on that end because I'm just so busy trying to figure out what's possible managing our two sites. And my strong point is more in the technical design and management type of thing. I'm basically a handyman with my day-to-day homesteader farmer. But there are plenty of people in permaculture who that's their deal. They're focused on education. They're focused on the social side. Mm-hmm. There's naturally children are very inclined towards this. So it's actually not an uphill battle if we start at a young age. Permaculture is a household term in Australia. And there's like public permaculture school curricula in Australia. I think it's actually in many schools. Younger schools have permaculture language taught and understanding of the possibility of regeneration, not just sustainability. I think it's happening. But in most of the world, especially the United States, the focus is on quote unquote academic achievement. And we're just trying to keep up with metrics that we used to be better at and right. Now are worse at, like STEM. We're throwing out a lot of other possibilities for that process, unfortunately. You know, I have a son who's 6 and a half and he lives this life with us to a large extent. He'll come to understand some of what took me into my 20s to wrap my head around without having to unlearn it first.
Oh, that's so wonderful. And there'll be a trickle effect for sure.
Yeah, trickle, and so much comes through osmosis. I mean, So much of this has to be an embodied thing, right? It's not something You just pour into someone's brain. You live it, you see it. Oh, you tend a seed, you plant a tree when you're in kindergarten. Every year you care for that tree. And when you graduate, you're climbing up in that tree with your girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever. And, you know, the meaning of that doesn't have to be explained.
Right. Absolutely. You bring to mind one of my earliest experiences, why I love being around growing food, being a kid in grammar school. What is the little seed you're going to plant this year? What's going to come up? And watching that thing, you nourish it and watch it grow. It's magic. Mm-hmm. For a child, it's like, wow.
Yeah. You can improve the world. You make a world every day. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's in some ways, I think it's about the greatest gift we can give. I mean, we can help give our children or not even give is the wrong word. I think it's supposed to allow them to experience.
In addition to your son, I think you have young people come take the design courses.
Yeah, we've had definitely teenagers. Yeah, teenagers come for our courses, is the youngest. There's more and more interest, especially by homeschool families, in bringing their kids even below teenage years. And that's starting to happen. We have a permaculture kids camp, too. I forgot to mention that my wife runs, and we're in our third year, and those are full week-long permaculture kids camp and a week-long herbalism kids camp where kids is potion-making camp for 4 to 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds, and called foraging and learning plant ID and what plants can be allies for our own health, how to identify them, how to find them, how to work with them to make medicine and things like that. Nothing more beautiful to me than to see a child know what's in the world around them, in the living world, not just the given human-made world, but the world that's eons old, and know how to work with that to help themselves.
Yeah,
it's the most empowering thing.
Absolutely.
Never go hungry. Help themselves heal a cut. My son and other kids in these courses are in these camps. Know to find plantain when they have a cut and chew it up and make a spit poultice or yarrow and put it on their cut and like stop the bleeding wildly quickly. Like some of these things work really, really well, and they're free and they're just all around us. These gifts are there in the world. But if we walk through the world with a blindness to all the gifts, then that begets a lack, right? That begets the hole that we carry around, which it seems like the entire economy, consumerist mindset is ready to capitalize on.
Without doubt.
So let's talk about some of the methods you use. You rewrote the book, The Resilient Farm and Homestead. The second edition is now out, just came out, I think, in February. And there are some practices that you've changed over the years that you used to do. Maybe we can just get into a few of the details, some of the things you've done.
Yeah, there's a revised everything, updated how well certain things work or didn't after. You know, a lot of things change between your 10 and 20. You can make a lot of cool things seem awesome to you for 3 to 5, 8 years because you're really managing them heavily, but they don't stand the test of time for various reasons. So yeah, it was a big update on a lot of that. So everything is suggested. For instance, Yacon was a species that was really exciting to me when I wrote the last book. And then I realized it has certain limitation climate-wise, especially here, and storage-wise. So I updated that. I don't think is a great strategy. You can, hey, don't have to make that mistake that I made. Or maybe you can try it if your context is different.
I tried it and it didn't grow.
Yeah. Same with rice. Same with so many things. There's a whole new section on lots of other things like greenhouses, which I really got to only start experimenting with as the book was coming to publish, like our glass greenhouse on our original site and then two other versions of greenhouses. There's a whole zone four permaculture, which is more like wild tending, light management, tending the wild, so to speak, of larger areas as we've been managing our larger second site. We've been learning a whole, you know, update on the wood hot water system, which just from a technical standpoint is just such low hanging fruit to heat your hot water with your wood stove. There's a bunch of key updates on that. And there's dozens of other things. The beginning of the book outlines all the changes.
Now, to do that heating the water with your wood stove, it's hard to do a retrofit, right?
No, it's not that hard. Actually, some wood stoves do, cook stoves especially, come with that loop in them. But no, what I've moved to doing is retrofitting all my stoves with stainless tubing. We have an online course which details how to do this because it's a bit hard to explain in words adequately. But you have to drill some holes in metal and insert some metal tubing. Besides sweating copper pipe, like it's pretty easy to do if you have some basic plumbing skills. If not, someone can help you. And it's cheap to do. You have to do it in certain ways for safety, but that goes with any heating system, no different than any other heating system. And you can get all your hot water. I mean, we get 3 people's worth of hot water for 4 to 5 months of the coldest time of year when we're really running the stove a lot, while just as a side benefit of heating our house. And I take 20-minute showers sometimes. I lie down on my back, put my legs up and brush my teeth and try to do anything I can in the shower because it's just so therapeutic and we have the hot water. I wouldn't do that if I was on propane hot water. I'd be a little more frugal because I'm paying for it and I'm burning ancient energy. Yeah, between wood stove hot water for the winter and couple solar hot water panels in the summer, right around the last few weeks of this time of year, April, May is when we switch over, and we're just on solar all summer for the cost of running a little pump, which could be run on a solar PV panel, solar direct hot water. You can't beat that system. You need hot water, at least unless you're living very rustic. Hot water is about as key as having heat in your house, almost. Yeah. And I think it uses a lot of energy. If you're not addressing it, will represent potentially a quarter of your energy use or more if you have a well-insulated house.
And I think you said you heat a fairly large, not too well-insulated house on 2 cords of wood and get all your hot water.
The original house that was on the original site, that is on the original site, yeah, can get by on about 2 cords. This winter was a little less. We had a mild winter, plus all the hot water and as much as we want to cook on it and bake in it, which is a bunch, although propane range doesn't use much propane to cook on. So it's small leverage. Yeah. And it's got an entire wall of west facing glass. I mean, it's not remotely even very well insulated, never mind like super tight, super insulated. And the studio, little apartment we built, is much better insulated, and that gets by on like a cord, you know, cord and a quarter. The latter is 1,500 square feet, and the former is about 1,800 plus. So they're not big houses. Incidentally, that's twice, 1,800 square feet is almost twice the size of your average home in Western Europe, in wealthier Europe. But in the United States, it's, you know, the average, I guess, is about 3,000.
Isn't that crazy?
I just saw a map of that. It's average home in the U.S. is 2,000. An average home in Europe is 1,000 half. Even Northern Europe, like Norway, was 800 square feet. Wealthy, wealthy nation. 800 square foot average family home or average home. And in the U.S., it's, you know, like 2,200, I think.
But when you think about it, Ben, when you walk into one of these typical homes, and we're in the Berkshires, so some of them are not so typical.
Yeah.
You walk in, you look around, and you say, a lot of wasted space here.
Oh, it's amazing.
It's kind of crazy. Mm-hmm. You say, that's not my design. Yeah, I totally get it. We really have this overconsumption built into us at a very early age.
The book has a lot of charts and specifics. I was looking at the first edition, and we're going to get that second edition. I was looking at the beginning, the part you can read for free on the A site. Let's do some contact information, too. We're about halfway through the show.
Yeah, it's a good time to do.
Sure. Yeah, Whole Systems Design, our website, is probably the best way. WholeSystemsDesign.com.
Wonderful.
Great. So let's just paint a picture of, you've got a 10 or 12 acre site, and then you've got a much larger site, right? Your newer site.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where are they and what's the land like?
Yeah, they're in Vermont and they're in the mountains of Vermont. So it's not agricultural land. The second site has some agricultural soil. So that allows us to do more rows and a little more, I don't say conventional, but more manageable in some ways because we can fence rows. It's bigger. We can use cows to keep the grass down and to build fertility and manage in between the plants. So the whole thing doesn't become a jungle. And the original site is, you know, a kind of steep 20% grade hillside with not nearly as good soils, more clay, a lot of boulders, even small cliffs, a lot of water, high water table. So that in some ways, if I didn't have that site to start, I wouldn't have been as creative because permaculture and a lot of creative responses, right, tend to come from adversity and challenges. And when you have something easier, you don't tend to be as innovative. Yeah, they're very different. I do a lot more logging on the second site. I log all my firewood and saw timber. I have a sawmill and we make our own buildings out of wood from the land. So yeah, they have their differences, but they're both really oriented to be homesteads more than farms. I mean, they both produce more than we can use of certain resources, but I don't make my living selling farm products completely as a farmer. I also teach and do site design services for people, as we were talking about.
Right.
And you know, sell some books and things like that.
And one of those is the Hotchkiss School, which is near our listeners. Just wondering if they've been going with that design.
Yeah, they've been using aspects of that design for sure. I don't think they've yet planted a lot of the trees that we were encouraging them to plant with some of our designs. But yeah, they're doing great stuff with their farm. And they grow a lot of food for the campus in a really careful way. They have a great grazing operation there, especially. And they grow a lot of veggies, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great model of like local food system in a school.
Great. So you do sites all over New England or further?
Yeah, all over the... We've designed stuff all over the country. And I've done site consults in other countries, too. Gone as far as Patagonia for site consults. Yeah, we mostly New England. We have our offices in Vermont and Maine. So yeah, most of our design work is in driving distance.
Mm-hmm.
I know we're stepping back a little bit when we were talking about climate change. So how are you adapting and contributing to the solution? What are your recommendations to other folks who maybe aren't as technically savvy as you are, but can employ some things that they, you know, so they're not feeling like, oh, it's mm-hmm. way beyond me.
Yeah. Well, one of the lowest hanging fruits is looking to warmer and colder other climate zones, especially warmer climate zones, to get a sense of what to plant and what to grow. So we're inspired by and have been planting the oak hickory mosaic for 20 years, but we're in the northern hardwood complex of forests, the beech birch maple dominated woodlands that don't really have oak and hickory. But you drive south of here or just over the Champlain Valley, 1-2 climate zones warmer, which we're probably becoming, although it's not quite that simple. And we can see multiple types of hickories, many types of oaks, and a lot of other diversity that we traditionally haven't had here. And that's a good thing. There's so many good things about the planet warming up. It's not just a catastrophe. I mean, there's plenty of catastrophes, don't get me wrong. But there's also a lot of, when life gives you lemons, make lemonade. I mean, you got to put your sail up when the wind's blowing. You take advantage of it or not. And the changes are still happening. Much more than trying to change the weather patterns, we're just focused on adaptation. And there's a lot of opportunity there. So we have shagbark hickory growing, you know, on hillsides here, and even a shellbark, which is the largest native nut to the United States, Caria species, 5 types of white oak, none of which are in this town or even this county or even in this ecoregion along the spine of the Green Mountains, unless they're planted. But if they're planted, they thrive. And you
I was
know,
just
going
to ask, do they do well?
Oh, yeah. Black walnut, not something that's been in the Green Mountains generally all the way from Massachusetts to Canada. You could have planted them 100 years ago. You'd have 100-year-old black walnuts. And so a few people did with black walnuts. And where that's happened, there's a very small number. You see them and we collect those seed and we replant those and actually breed those because that's a hugely valuable genetic resource. But we're doing that with other plants that people really haven't much with, like English oak, swamp white oak, chestnut oak, Quercus alba, regular old white oak. Red oak is the only oak that really has been here for a while. That seed just got up here earlier after the ice melted, probably by native peoples, because they've been knowing the need to do this assisted migration for time immemorial. And that's just a human thing. You move valuable seed when you travel because you want to live and not die in the following winter, or at least have your kids have an easier time in the future. So yeah, we've been doing that assisted migration work for a long time. And most everything we've planted has thrived. Some things have been really challenging, like persimmon, to get persimmon to grow here,
right?
American persimmon. We have a few on our original site. Our second site's a little too cold. We're right on that edge. We've tried. We planted hundreds of them. They've all died on our second site. We planted 400 pawpaws on our second site. Those all died. On our first site, we actually have a 20-foot tall pawpaw tree that's 15 years old. So we can feel the edge climate-wise, but it's always shifting. And soils also contribute to that, actually, which I have an update on in my book, which I didn't realize for about the first 15 years, as far as what can be moved in its hardiness zone, the wetter the soils, actually the more you can overwinter within reason, because things actually die of drought in the winter and it looks like cold stress, but it's contributed to by drought.
Wow.
Yeah, that took me a while to realize. Managing two sites has helped me realize a lot of things I wouldn't have if I only managed one, because I can compare and contrast soils, especially, and climates.
So site two is in a valley, right? So you get those really cold,
It's kind of in a valley, but it's also high up. So yeah, it's pretty exceptionally cold. So it's a good test.
High valley, a good test site.
You know, I mean, if we can get something to overwinter here, like shagbark hickory, I feel pretty confident almost anyone in Vermont can. There might be some edges up in Northeastern Kingdom that's not true for, but it's a great test site. So yeah, I mean, essentially, just to keep on your question, we can look to warmer zones, and that's a great thing if you're in a place like we are. Obviously, if you're in Louisiana already, then looking to warmer zones may not be an advantage, or maybe not be such good news because it's already so hot. But for us in New England, longer growing season, great. Typically, that's what's happening. But it's also not just global warming. I mean, it's climate change, it's global weirding, as Amory Lovin said.
Right.
So we also had one of the coldest winters in a century, 11 winters ago, which was the first winter that our major 10,000 tree planting went in, our big original planting of our second site. But that was kind of cool because then it culled out a lot of stuff like the persimmons and pawpaws I mentioned.
Sure.
So now if it survived that, this is all worth caring for because that was a culling.
That was a great test.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, if that happened in year four, we would have cared for all of them and then they would have all died after wasting a bunch of time caring for some of those things.
Yeah.
So it was very good. But it also rained a lot. Well, last summer rained a lot, but then we had 3 years of drought. We couldn't have established this system as easily 3, 4, 5 years ago, 2 years ago, as we did 11, because we used to get very reliable rains in the summer. And lately, it's just been continuous flooding or serious drought. So we wouldn't have been able to water, or it would have been a huge ask to try to water 7,000 feet of hedgerow.
So I want to go back to the nut trees. Oak, do you process the oak acorns yourself or do you let the animals do the processing?
Both. We're only 15 to 18 years into planting oak. So our first bur oak on our original site has been bearing for a few years, but we're just getting into harvesting our own oaks. They take a while. But where there are red oak in the northern Vermont, which there are some, yeah, we harvest, collect, we broadcast to try to get them going in more places all over, even off our property, assisting the dispersal and migration of that species, expanding its native range as climate change obligates us to do. But yeah, you can process, you just have to leach all acorns, but it's all top-end food. It's been a staff of life for any indigenous group that's had access to oaks, tended to live off those trees in a pretty primary, if not totally primary way, like California. The dozens of native tribes of California, as you know, probably were huge on the acorn.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then also we plant all this stuff for the wildlife too, partly just for the wildlife value, but also because wildlife is food. And I hunt a little. I'm not a huge hunter, but in the future, if I need to hunt more, I can. We're essentially planting a game park, encouraging, you know, let's grow wildlife with our plantings, which is not a new idea. I mean, even Aldo Leopold talked about wildlife as a farm yield. If you farm in a really good way, you're actually growing wildlife. That's one of your crops.
Now, speaking of crops and water and all those things, I want to know a little bit more about a couple of things. Sea berries, fish on a bush, and Nanking cherries, because you talked about a lot of, you know, the flooding. And I remember reading that Nanking cherries, which I have never had the privilege of eating, like a little bit of wetter soil.
They can deal with it. They can deal with it.
They can deal with it. And sea berry, fish on a bush, obviously, California is a very different climate. Now that we're in New England, we're going to think about trying it again. How successful have you been with those sea berries?
Very. They really are great, although they're not drought tolerant like all the literature says. That's one of the things that the second site also allowed us to see, because there wasn't much dry ground in the first site.
Right.
And the second site has a lot of drought tending ground, and they like a lot of moisture. So whatever you read, that's kind of fake news. And I can just tell you from doing it for 20 years and trying it in all sorts of different ground. And they love not a wetland, but right next to a, on a pond berm where they shoot up at waterline in like mounds in wetlands, and generally ground that's sopping wet in the wet times, but drains in the dry times. They're really happy. If it's well drained all the time and gets really dry in the growing season, they'll actually die. I mean, they're one of the only plants I've had die of drought.
Wow.
We get slow growth on a lot of things from drought, but straight up die, I'd say Seaberry is the only one. And they're known as this incredibly drought tolerant plant. I don't know. It makes no sense. I don't understand that, but it's just
that's
what
why
I
we planted so many in California. That's why we planted them in California.
I know. I
that's why they died too.
I have a
interesting
question.
Yeah. I mean, but I feel like they must be drought tolerant in places, because some people plant them with success in Saskatchewan, which is relatively dry compared to here. And I think parts of China where it's way dry. I can just tell you for 20 years, they proved to be about as least drought tolerant as it gets in this
climate. And
where
do you source them from?
Well, now I have so many, I just breed them myself. But I mean, for years we were buying from One Green World because he got a lot of genetics from Russia, which were the leaders, and Germany. But the German varieties don't do so well for us. The Russian are the ones, and Latvian too. I'm blanking on his name, but the guy who started One Green World out in Oregon, who's a legend, he did a lot of assisted migration of Seaberry and went to Russia and brought back a couple dozen plus varieties. And many of those are good for us. Not all, but we've been testing those, propagating those, kind of narrowed down to a handful of varieties that are really great.
Do you sell any? Do you have a nursery?
Yeah, so then we sell, I sell Seaberry, Nanking Cherry, Black Currant, Black Walnut. Those are primarily what I sell because they just do so well. I don't focus on all the other stuff, but and then I do have larger nut trees for sale too to clients and or to whoever wants to buy them for pickup on farm. And I mail some smaller plants in the spring, bare root. I only sell bare root. I don't pot anything up.
Right.
But for people who come to the farm, you know, there's a lot of genetics here to get for sure. I also sell Jerusalem artichokes.
You sell Jerusalem artichokes, did you say?
Yeah, they're such a great resilient plant, great visual screen, and, you know, the only food this time of year you can just get a staple crop out of the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So we propagate and sell those too.
And Nanking cherries, would they live very happily with the Seaberry bush? Would they get along because...
Most things get along with the Seaberry. It's just thorny, so you got to be careful of your own access. Whereas Nanking cherry is just a perfect edible landscape plant. I'm actually out on my deck here, lying down in the sun, and there's 8-foot by 8-foot Nanking cherries all around me, between me and the garden, and they're about to flower. They're just a perfect edible landscape shrub because they top out at 8x8 and you can just reach them all and access them, and they're beautiful, amazing proliferation of blossom this time of year, and then just loaded with cherry red fruit every June, July. We've had them where we invite all our neighbors over. They're still falling on the ground, mulching themselves with fruit. We make meads out of them and freeze them for juices in the winter. Although I barely have any fruit in the winter now. I eat so seasonally now, I just don't even really want fruit in the winter anymore like I used to. But that's just a personal transition as we calibrate ourselves to this climate more and more over time.
That makes so much sense.
Now, black walnut has juglone, and that suppresses other growth. And then I looked online, and there are a number of plants that you can plant under it, like Juneberry. And
the juglone-tolerant plants, it's bigger than I think people tend to think. But yeah, they'll just kill. Once they're mature, it takes a long time, as far as I'm learning. I still have like a lot of plants thriving under my 20-year-old black walnuts. But according to older people than me, they will start to kill some of those plants. That's okay. I want the black walnuts, and I've got a lot of those other plants everywhere else. But yeah, they don't play as nice because of the allelopathy that they have.
Yeah, I think I wanted to ask you what your experience was with plants that do well with them. It sounds like
black currant. I don't even know if I'm far enough in. I mean, year 20 might not be enough to see all of the allelopathy they're going to be doing. I don't think it is. So far, Seaberry doesn't seem to care much about them. Black currant, cherry is just dying off next to it. But that also could be because they don't like the heavy soils, because they're dying off all over on our original site. The most prunus, even plums, which are super vigorous for a bunch of years, no matter where you plant them, They're also short-lived. Plums are a successional plant. You're not planting a plum to have it in 50 years in the same tree. But yeah, they seem to be killing off some stuff, but not most.
Now, plums, what kind of plums are you growing up there? What would be your variety?
I mean, they're like American plum crosses, a lot of them. Winnetta, Toca, as far as name varieties. I'm forgetting if they're mostly a European.
I think it's Japanese, actually. Asian.
Japanese, yeah. It's been so many years since I planted plums because we really went heavy on them for the first 5 to 10 years. And then they started dying off on our original site. And we have actually an old grove on the original site. I really have planted almost none. They're, you know, super vigorous, pioneering, and they'll shoot up. They'll make a thicket. You got to be a little careful there if you don't want to manage many stems coming up. Don't plant plums. You got to mow around them or knock those stems down every now and then.
Yeah.
Or you run with them, which we're doing as you would with any thicket, like seaberry. You run with it so you could have an indefinite something that lives forever by choosing, okay, the mother tree's dying off. I'm choosing the next stem, and that's the next tree. And boom, boom, you keep doing that. You can do that forever. And just the tree you planted is constantly in a new place every 5 to 10 years, 20 years. But it's the same tree.
Slow version of strawberry or raspberry, which do the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's like running. Paul Stamets calls it running with mycelium. It's, they also do that with plants. You run with plants and you got to keep ahead of them and allow them to keep moving. I mean, even apples will do that over hundreds of years. So yeah, they're prolific, but I don't tend to plant more. For us, the most reliable is pear and apple. It's just bar none. They're in their own category. Like if you're just going to plant in our climate. But even right down in the Hudson Valley, I have a very close friend and colleague and plant ninja who's like, apples just are totally disease obliterated because I think there's just so much more commercial apple there promoting the pests. And it's a warmer climate and the cold climates are better for pests. So he has a tough time with apples and he comes up here and he's like, wow, you're in the apple kingdom up here in the mountains of Vermont. It's just, I mean, we have a million wild apples in this town probably right now.
And you don't have a lot of curculio and coddling moth?
So the curculio completely nails the plums. If you don't spray that with clay, oftentimes you won't get any plums, which is one reason I also don't plant, because we've sprayed with clay, but I don't want to spray. If a tree has to be sprayed with clay every spring multiple times, I'm just going to grow stuff that doesn't have to have that happen. There's enough other things. My whole deal isn't just being a horticulturist. I'm not a fruit salesman, so... Yeah, but they don't bother the apples, it seems, very much, even though they're supposed to. I mean, last year we had 19 degrees on May 16th or May 19th or something. Full blossom, should have had no apples. And we had a giant bonkers apple year, couldn't harvest them all, feeding buckets and buckets to the cows every day, just from apples right around the house and barn. And you could drive around the road, pull up a pickup under a tree, climb up in the tree, shake it, and like have literally 1,000 pounds of apples in your pickup in an hour doing that from the wild trees. They're just so resilient in that way. And all the commercial orchards basically had a hellacious year because of that frost, which is pretty fascinating. I think that's a genetic and also microclimate thing. Yeah.
It could also be the health of your soil that gives the apples the ability to fight off disease. I mean, Michael Phillips promoted spring, all kinds of things. And Nigel Palmer has some additions.
For sure. No, that's a good point. But even the wild trees, which have...
The wild trees.
Are like that. But you could make a case, and you'd be right, I think, that the wild trees have way better soil than an orchard tree does. Because it's just, you know, totally full of woody debris and all sorts of good stuff. I think that might be a big part of things.
Now, I want to ask you, just for people who are listening, do you have any workshops coming up? Do you have...
Yeah, our flagship course is our permaculture design course, 10 days in early August every year. We have about 5 spots left, so it usually fills, but it's not quite full yet for this year. And so that's our main offering. It's super fun, learning vacation kind of thing. People from all over the world come and camp. And also we have some rooms in one of the houses for 10 days in August, learning about all of this and more, and immersing in the systems and in the ponds and, you know, in the landscape itself. That's our main offering. And then I do have some online courses on our website, too, that we're continuing to come out with.
And if you don't mind, could you give that information again, the website that they...
So it's the Whole Systems Design website and the Whole Systems Design Permaculture course. You could Google that, too, and find it. And find us, Whole Systems Design Ben Falk. We'll find us pretty easily on the web. Yeah.
And I just want to talk a little... little bit more. We have a few minutes. Yeah, we have a few minutes left, and I want to talk. Yeah, of course, of course. I want to talk about calories in medicine and medicinal plants, and what are the things that you might recommend to listeners in largely in the Berkshire area that they could be focusing on at this time of year, which is our early, well, you know, with us, I don't know if it's the same thing up there. I call it spring happens for 15 minutes and then you have this lukewarm summer.
Right, right.
You know, so go ahead.
Yeah, even more lukewarm here. But yeah. Hopefully we'll have a real one this year. Last summer was so, you know, we got 25 inches of rain during the growing season.
Yeah.
Good for tree growth, but not great for squash yields and tomato yields, that's for sure. There's so many things. Like, we're harvesting nettle like crazy right now. The nettle, I'm sure, is up high enough there, and it's just getting up here. Although it's actually about a foot up on our original site and 4 inches on the second site. So you see the microclimate difference. And we make tea. My old friend Sean says, you know, you've had too much nettle tea when your face turns green, which doesn't ever happen. So you really can't overdo it. It's like the best multivitamin, just very gentle, immune supportive, mineralizing tea. So we just make tons of that every day. Then we dry it in the next month or so once it's really up. But before it really goes to seed, or even after, we'll dry a ton as quickly as we can under shade, but a warm, dry day, and then jar it, just pack it into 1/2-gallon jars and do that all winter. That's a great one. And that's like a weed almost. So it's abundant all over the place. And stinging nettle, wear some leather gloves when you harvest. And then there's so much else. And we'll do a less of a version with that with comfrey before it flowers only. Although comfrey you want to be more ginger with, but that can be good in the mix. But same with Leonora's cardiaca, motherwort. That's very much more bitter, but it really adds a medicinal to that tea. We have what we call our green juices, nettle, blackcurrant leaves, a little bit of comfrey leaves, and an even smaller amount of motherwort in the blender, spoonful of holcomb honey from our hives that we saved, maybe a sprig of salt, maybe not, in the blender with water. Or if you really want to get fancy, sap that you just froze from a month ago when sap season was going, melted, thawed into the blender, blend it up, squeeze it through a nut milk bag. And that's just this like IV of vitality into your cells. Currant leaves are amazing, by the way. Black currant leaves, not any other, but black currant leaves, although they smell weird, they're like an incredibly floral tea. And wow, great for ferments too, because they have a lot of tannins.
You're saying comfort before the flowers. How much is a little? Because I've heard that it was, well, I've heard a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot of info that the oxalates or the alkaloids, I guess the alkaloids in comfrey, once they flower, they spike. Tons of plants have those. I mean, comfrey's not unique.
Right.
You got to be aware of that with lots of plants. Before they flower, long regarded by people who know, I think, that it's fine to do. But according to, I'm sure, USDA or whoever, you should never touch that plant for all sorts of reasons. I'm not recommending that officially, but it's well regarded as good before flowering. You can always keep cutting it, so you could have it all summer. But obviously, comfrey is super medicinal for tissue healing topically, not taken internally. Yeah. But internally can help with those same things and even assist them even more. Bone knit, they call that plant, because of its ability to just help bones heal really quickly. So quick is it in cellular regeneration that if you have a puncture wound, it's contraindicated, because you don't want that wound to seal up too quickly to make sure it's not infected. But there's so many medicinals. We grow a bunch of echinacea, although we don't use it heavily as medicinal for us. It's more medicinal for the landscape. I mean, one thing we found, we grow a lot of medicinals, my wife's an herbalist, is that once it's in the landscape, after a bunch of years, you stop using it, so to speak, using, like in quotes, making tinctures, teas, a lot of things we used to do, now we barely do. We make some teas still, we dry some stuff, but we barely use any tinctures. But those same plants are just, we live with, and they're around us. And my wife relays how she studied with Rosemary Gladstar, the famous herbalist, who had that same thing happen to her. And when she was apprenticing with Rosemary, she said, oh, you're not really using these plants much. And she said, oh, no, I'm using them. I don't need to harvest them to use them. They're here now. Their benefits are coming into our life without having to always harvest them. And we've actually found that. I used to think, oh, I want to make tinctures out of this, that, and the other thing. Put up like 20 different tinctures from hawthorn to you name it. And then we just wouldn't really need those tinctures after a bunch of years. And now the plants are in our ecosystem. They're in our home. We kind of share space with them. We don't really take too many of them anymore.
You know, That makes me mindful. It brings up an old book you might have remembered. It was a big trend, Celestine Prophecy, talking about
right.
when we get to that evolved state, we can just be with the
right
and glean all of the nutrients just because we are exactly coexisting.
Yeah, it's almost like, and no shade on taking tinctures and any of that, but it's almost like that is a intermediate step to help us move to places where we don't always have to be dependent on actually consuming those things.
I do like to consume things like the chickweed, but I also just love to watch it. I just get so much joy seeing the abundance of it growing out.
Yeah, chickweed's like a chickweed we didn't plant in our greenhouse, and it's totally like quote unquote weed there, but we then learned how good it is by tasting it and reading more about it. And it's like, yeah, it's one of our main salad greens. So hearty. And that's so much of what living in congruence with the biological world is, right? Like learning to understand the value in what is given, not what we just made, but all the things that happen to be around us, so that we can do less and less every year and still live as good of a life, because we start realizing through literacy, through understanding, how to make use of those things that are around us and what's really being provided for us that we didn't realize was being provided for us without having to plant, having to always do, make, buy, transform, etc.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely.
That's some Garden of Eden stuff right there, right?
I mean, right.
That was the fall from grace, I'm pretty sure, is that we started to have to do all this stuff.
Oh, we just so love having this interview with you, and thank you so much for your time. On that note, we've been getting an abundance of the garlic mustard. And, you know, it's true. I always say that Mother Nature gives us what we need.
Mm-hmm. Think about the profusion of knotweed now, and as Lyme disease gets to those same places 10 years later, 15 years later, and the medicine for the Lyme disease is there. Not perfect medicine, it's not going to fix it necessarily, right. But a huge benefit, an ally with the resveratrol and for other reasons. Yeah, it's a shame to see people still fighting wild plants that behave in ways they don't think they want them to, when there's so much value there if we're willing to see and utilize it.
And the shoots of those knotweed are really nice. They're kind of like a mild rhubarb almost.
Right. Yep. Yeah. It's so abundant. It's about the latest pollinator in this area for not just bees, but a lot of pollinators use it.
Oh, right. They use the flower of the knotweed.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's even later than goldenrod, which is kind of one of the regarded late. Yeah, goldenrod now is honestly often finishing in August and September, not even going to October lately in the last bunch of years. So that's not very late. A lot of pollinators are still flying.
I used to not care for goldenrod until I read about how wonderful and nutritious it was, and was like, oh, gee, I'm chewing on this.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't. That's cool. I got to look more into that. I appreciate them way more now than I did as I'm a beekeeper. When I was just grazing sheep, I was like, oh, this is a terrible weed. And, you know, it's just so interesting how a weed's in the eye of the beholder, right? It's our own limitation. And I was just grazing, and it is a weed to fields. I mean, it's not very palatable for really any grazing animal, and it kind of not good for hay, but it's helping things turn into the forest. It's helping get this next succession going, change your attitude, change what you're doing. And it's a huge asset.
Absolutely.
For sure. But yeah, the asters are super late, as you mentioned. They're only one. They're not necessarily super abundant.
Right.
As the goldenrod. Jerusalem artichoke's even later than all of that, but it sometimes doesn't even get to flower. It's so late here before the cold sets in.
It does flower in our area, though.
Yeah, for us, we're really on edge. I mean, it really doesn't always get there.
It's been wonderful to have you on the show, Ben.
Great to be here.
And once again, your book, your second edition of the Resilient
Farm and Homestead, Chelsea Green Press.
Yeah.
Chelsea Green Press. Yep. Resilient Farm and Homestead.
We love the first.
And that's the best place to get it right now, more than the monopolizing retailers. I sometimes have it on my website, signed copies too, but I'm out right now.
Right. Yeah. I looked today and it looked like I had to go to Chelsea Green to find it.
Yeah. Thanks so much for your time, guys.
You're so welcome.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, guys.
We hope you're taking advantage of all the spring greens, from the low-growing, segmented, tiny white-flowered chickweed to the infamous garlic mustard. Great in salads, green smoothies, or if you're pulling it out as an invasive, consider it a nutritious gift. Always harvest any leafy green away from busy roads. We're now drying spring greens for next winter, and you can too. This is WBCR LP Great Barrington, Berkshire Community Radio, broadcasting at 97.7 FM and streaming at berkshireradio.org. Archives of past shows can be found at berkshireradio.org, where you can also donate to this great station. Thanks for listening.